Today is Monday, February 8th, 2010. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I talk with Alejandra Goyenechea, International Counsel at the International Conservation Program of Defenders of Wildlife, and also chair of the Species Survival Network's Amphibian Working Group. We'll talk about the importance of amphibians and the many threats to their survival. But first, let me repeat more of the creature calls from the wildlife's first creature call contest. On January 18th, I played a series of 10 creature calls and gave listeners of both the radio show and podcast 4 weeks until February 15th to email me their guesses. The person who guesses the most creature calls correctly will win a copy of my book, Animal Investigators: How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. It's a wildlife CSI, and it was published by Scribner. If you're interested in entering, you can get detailed hints on these and the rest of the calls by listening to the January 18th podcast of the show. You can download this and other podcasts of The Wildlife at iTunes, my website, laurelnemi.com, or at laurelnemi.podbean.com. Let me now play creature call number 5 from the contest. The animal that makes this sound is a dangerous reptile that can grow to over 7 feet long and lives throughout the Southwest. Here's creature call number 5. Now, let me turn to my conversation on the amphibian trade with Alejandra Goyenechea. Alejandra is International Counsel at the International Conservation Program of Defenders of Wildlife, and also chair of the Species Survival Network's Amphibian Working Group. Her primary focus is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, also known as CITES, and other international trade law issues, with an emphasis on Latin America. She has worked at several international institutions and organizations and has experience in wildlife policy and broader experience in other environmental areas. For example, during her work with the Mexican government, she represented the Environmental Enforcement Agency at the international level. She also has interned or worked at the Organization of American States, the United Nations Environment Program North American Office, and the DC law firm Baker Botts. After earning her law degree in Mexico, Alejandra completed her master's degree, LLM, in International Environmental Law at the Washington College of Law at American University, with a Fulbright scholarship. She speaks fluent English, Spanish, and French, which serves her well as she travels the globe from South America to Madagascar, protecting frogs, salamanders, and other unusual creatures. When we talked recently, I asked Alejandra why amphibians are so important.
There are a lot of benefits of amphibians in this world. I mean, first of all, they are an indicator of environmental quality. So they can tell us if something is wrong with the environment. They're very beneficial to both human and the ecosystem health. For example, this is related, I mean, they have antibiotic and anti-tumor properties that we can take from their skin. And also very, very, very important for a lot of humid countries is that they consume thousands of insects. And what this does is that they can help crops reduce, and they can reduce insect-borne diseases. They can help with malaria. They can help control what's around in crops and what's good for us.
So they're not only like canaries in a coal mine for environmental quality, but they also have properties for medicines and then also helping us with not only just insect-borne diseases, but having, medicinal properties in and of themselves and also just helping crops by reducing pests, right?
Right. And let me give you an example of one tiny frog.
And how big is this tiny frog?
It's so tiny. It's 1 centimeter. It goes from 1 centimeter to 4 centimeters. And this is it's the phantasmal poison frog, which is a species of the Epipedobates genus. And it's a tiny poison dart frog that lives in Ecuador. And this frog, actually, it's very interesting, but it has a very, very particular medicinal use. It's a painkiller. It's a painkiller that is 200 times as potent as morphine.
Really?
And yeah, it is. Exactly. It's used for muscle relaxants. And I mean, it's so tiny, but we can use so much out of it.
Wow. And how did they even discover that?
Good question. I'm not a biologist. it's amazing. I mean, it's amazing the work that biologists do in their field. That's what they do. They go out in the field and that's what they do, same as plants, and they go and do that. But but a lot of the frogs do have a special property. And I mean, we can talk about this. I mean, I'm going to go out of your question. I mean, I don't want to go out of your question. But there's so many uses that we can have of amphibians. I mean, other than being beneficial to our health and to the ecosystem. I mean, we can use them for food. We can use them for scientific research. We can use them as pets. We can use them as ornaments, as jewelry. There's really a lot of uses of amphibians, but of course in a sustainable manner, because I mean amphibians unfortunately are really in danger, and they're really going, a lot of them.
Now we're talking, when we talk about amphibians, are we mostly talking frogs or also newts and salamanders as well? Sort of give me mm-hmm. a picture of sort of the range of amphibians, and how many are there?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, actually, so amphibians include frogs, toads, salamanders, and Sicilians.
Okay.
And how many there are? Well, according to the IUCN is is one kind of like the institution for biodiversity and for wildlife. So according to the IUCN Red List, there are 6,285 species.
Are most of them just very common, or do a lot of them have protection as well?
A lot of them are really in the verge of extinction. I don't have exactly how much are like now critically endangered.
So let me just back up for a minute. Of those more than 6,000 mm-hmm. amphibians, where are they? Are they in particular countries or particular regions, or can they be found all over?
Where you're going to find the biggest concentration of amphibians is certainly where in countries with rich biodiversity. And what is that? It's going to be going to find in tropical countries, such as Central America. I mean, Central America is a very rich area. Central America, like, it goes all the way down to Venezuela, Colombia. There, I mean, you're going to find a big concentration of amphibians. Also, the other place is going to be, amazingly, Southeast Asia. So Indonesia, Philippines, that also. And you even find amphibians in the desert. I mean, in kind of like mountainous areas of Iran, for example, in China, all over. But the biggest concentration is where there's countries with a rich biodiversity.
And then are many of those species in danger of extinction? Sort of what proportion is under threat?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, it's interesting that they just declared, this was last year, that a third of amphibians are in danger of extinction.
Wow, and that's incredible.
It is terrible. And actually, it's really, I mean, it's terrible. But you can compare it, and you know what's the danger of this is that also last year IUCN declared that one-fourth of mammals are in danger of extinction. So you can see that amphibians are worse in shape than mammals today.
Wow. And then of that, what are the threats to amphibians?
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of them, and it's caused by us, and most of them. So when the first one we can say is habitat loss, you also have pollution, chemicals that we throw in our gardens, the chemicals from the industries, pollution from cities, from crops. Mm-hmm. Climate change, of course, so this affects the skin. Invasive species, a lot of people cannot think of this, but yes, it is interesting that if the government or us, we like to introduce in a pond trout or other kind of fish, and let's say, oh, let's grow this new fish in this pond so we can have some fishing and have some fun in here. Well, sometimes those new species that are introduced in lakes, ponds, whatever, they are invasives, and they eat the frog legs and the eggs of the amphibians, and they're not used to that. Another threat for the amphibians is diseases. That's another big topic that we can talk about. Just in summary, is one of the biggest diseases that amphibians are going through now is a fungus. It's a fungus that is affecting them and is killing them.
Tell me more about this fungus.
It's amazing how fast this is reproducing. And it's what these fungus do is that it prevents the skin to breathe properly, because as we know, amphibians, they breathe through the skin. So it
prevents really the skin from breathing. So it affects the respiration.
Exactly. So, and this is kind of like affecting, and this is also transmitted through the water. So you can imagine, I mean, frogs, they live in the water. So this just transmits so rapidly, and it's exterminating populations of amphibians.
Are there other threats to amphibians?
Overexploitation is a big, big, big threat that was just recognized also last year in the IUCN.
Do you know how many are affected by trade?
Out of more than 6,000 species, 141 are affected by trade. What this means is that the main threat has to be trade, but a lot of species are threatened by climate change, for example, and trade, and this is sometimes is hard to take into account. So there can be much, much, much more than 141 that are affected by trade.
Okay, so because it's hard to determine if it's 51% or 48% affected by trade, their populations decline. So for trade, what are some of the main uses? Why do people want to buy these?
Why do we want to use them? Yes, exactly. We want to use them to eat. We want to use them as pets. We want to use them for medicinal purposes, and we want to also use them for scientific purposes.
Can you tell me about some of the species for each use and where they're from?
For the food trade, you're going to find some of the species that are mostly from Southeast Asia, like the Fergervara genus, the Limnonectes genus, and these will serve several areas of the world. Also, you have in Chile very large species that is found and is the most traded also for the food industry.
Okay, so different species are used for different things, which makes sense.
Exactly. And also, I mean, you'll find, I mean, for example, in the tropical countries, you're going to find most of them are going to be for the pet trade, because they're small, they're colorful, because that's where you're going to find them. It's like the colorful ones and the nicest ones are from the tropical countries. You're also going to find the nicest ones from Madagascar. I mean, you might even have seen them in the stores in here. It's the Mantellas genus, and they're tiny, 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 and they're could be yellow, orange, and they're really beautiful, and that's why they're in big demand all over the world.
What about for medicinal purposes?
For medicinal purposes, it's amazing that there are 66 species that are used for medicinal purposes. And this is interesting fact, but for the scientific purposes, our pregnancy test, we have to thank the amphibians for that.
Really? What amphibian is used in the pregnancy test, really?
Yeah, it's a species called Xenopus lawensis, and he's from South Africa. And the scientists, what they used to do is just kind of like inject some urine on it and would try to use the frog to know if the person is pregnant or not. So that's how they started to develop the pregnancy tests.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, so many uses.
What are some of the other medicinal uses? You mentioned the one for painkillers at the beginning of the show. What are some of the others?
There's one in Mexico, actually, that is extracted from a lake. And also it's used in locally for medicinal purposes in order to, for the heart, for heart problems.
Is it usually sort of local traditional medicine that uses amphibians, or has it become a big industry now?
It started as kind of like a local thing, but as everything, I think that I could compare it as the plants. I mean, the plants were, I mean, they started to be used as a local medicine, and then just as soon as it's discovered by industry, it's exploited for the entire world to use as in for the entire world. I mean, as some of them just kind of like the tradition and stays in the area.
And then, is it legal to use amphibians for these purposes?
Well, that will depend on the laws of the country. But let me tell you that, for example, most of the countries, especially, for example, in Central America, the one that I'm a little bit more familiar with, they do have, for example, laws that prohibit the use or the export of wildlife. And a lot of them, it's amazing the laws that they have that completely prohibits the export or the use of wildlife. But unfortunately, there is very little enforcement in a lot of the countries. We have great laws. They're there, but it's very hard to enforce them.
Can you give me any examples?
I mean, I can tell you, I mean, most of the Central American countries, they do have a prohibition to export wildlife. And it is amazing. You have Costa Rica that has that. You have El Salvador that has that. And actually, they just had a law. And they do have that. But also, we know that that wildlife gets somewhere else, gets to the United States, it gets to Europe. But always when we turn out to officials, I mean, we know that, I mean, it says it is illegal to export wildlife.
What are some of the challenges of enforcement?
It's a very good question, but unfortunately, it's not that easy. Just say, well, let's just prohibit it, and that will be the solution. Mostly, and I think that the most important thing for enforcement is awareness programs.
What do you mean by that?
What we need is education to everybody, to the children, to us, to know that just wildlife, if you see a little frog that goes and then you go on a forest trip and you go and you find wildlife, just it belongs there. You don't take it. It looks cute in there, but that's where it belongs. So, well, first not to have it, not to take it as a pet, also not to consume it. And also the other problem is that governments and every governments, we have lack of sustainable harvesting methods. We also have lack of action plans for threatened species. I mean, some countries are more advanced than others. But unfortunately, the ones that have a richer biodiversity do not have that much capacity to develop these kind of plans. We have the problem of law enforcement, and this is not only, unfortunately, this is not only in countries in development. We have the problem here in the United States.
Tell me more about that.
We have lack of personnel. It's amazing that the United States says that we have a lack of personnel. And let me tell you that today there's only below 200 agents to enforce the laws, the wildlife laws. In 2002, there were 238 agents, which is nothing, but now we have below 200. And this is a big problem. Why? Because when you have all the ports of entries, and when you have that many imports that arrive at the ports of entries, not every agent is capable of reviewing all the shipments, and they're not trained to identify, for example, which are the species that are in danger, which are not. And this is amazing in amphibians. I mean, in amphibians, one species has, for example, black eyes, and then a little line on the side, and then another species which is threatened doesn't have the line, but the other one is fine. So how do you know, for example, which is the shipment that can go through or not? And when you have so many shipments waiting for you and it's live wildlife, it's very, very hard to enforce it.
So just identification of all the different species. Now, how many are protected? In the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, there are 114 species that are listed in Appendix 1.
And 2. I mean, this is a combination of 1 and 2. Okay. In Appendix 1, you have 16 species. And in Appendix 2, you have 98 species.
Okay. And then within that, are there guides so that you can know what they look like? How do you know which ones are which, I guess?
Just an expert can determine that. And our enforcement officers, they have been trained, but they can also, they have to be trained not only in amphibians, they have to be trained in all species of wildlife. So this is almost impossible. And let me tell you something. I mean, there are some guides that are done by some NGOs, but this is very hard because, as I'm telling you, and also the other thing is that some, for example, some amphibians, they're like chameleons. When they're sleeping, they look a certain way. When they're awake, they look another way. When it's a female, it can be also different. I mean, when they're juveniles, they look another way. So even somebody that kind of like has been trained in and has pictures of how it looks one next to the other one, it is very, very difficult to identify shipments and boxes of boxes of amphibians. And also, just also let me tell you in this, last year in 2008, Congress only allowed 59.6 million for law enforcement.
$59.6 million for law enforcement?
Yes. Which, I mean, it sounds a lot, but it does not. I mean, that is almost nothing to enforce the laws, and this is for everything.
Wow.
It's not only for wildlife, for amphibians. Yeah.
What is the volume of trade in amphibians?
The volumes are very interesting. The United States imported 4,000 tons from 1998 to 2002 of frog legs.
Now, that's only frog legs. What about, say, for the pet trade?
For example, another interesting data is that from 2003 to 2007, more than 11,000 live amphibians imported from Latin America, so to the United States, they were either critically endangered, or vulnerable. And 99.6% came from the wild. So more than the exact number is 11,262 live amphibians coming from Latin America. All of them came from the wild. Also, another data is that between 1999 and 2008, also in the U.S. we're talking, more than 207,000 specimens of just a single genus. Specimens is the individuals, right? Just like one frog. So more than 207,000 little frogs of just one genus, which is the genus of Agalignis. It's a very nice frog. Actually, you have seen it in like almost everywhere. It has like red eyes and has like a green body. They were imported to the U.S. in a frame of 10 years, more than 207,000.
Is that the red-eyed tree frog?
Yeah, the red-eyed, exactly. That's the red-eyed tree frog. Yeah, you'll see it everywhere. And 99.8% were used for commercial purposes, so pet stores, most of them.
And so depending on where it came from, it could be perfectly legal to import those frogs or to have them as a pet?
I mean, if there's no regulation, which mostly there is not, I mean, the only regulation that we have here, it would be the Lacey Act. But if it's not included in the Convention of International Trade of Endangered Species, which is the most commonly known as CITES, if it's not included in there, there is no regulation whatsoever that says that you have to present a paper saying it's legal. So when they come from, let's say, Costa Rica or from another country, and they were acquired illegally over there, there's nothing the United States can say that they cannot enter because there's no regulation saying you need to present a paper saying it is legal, if they're not, for example, included in CITES.
Okay.
And there's no control. In the United States, there is kind of like a record if people declare it. If people do not declare it, there's no way you can know how many frogs there are coming in.
How much do we really know about the amphibian trade? You had mentioned that the data was only what was declared. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the data that was obtained was through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service data. And this is because they're declaring it at the ports, when at the entry ports. So they're declaring, I'm bringing X numbers of frog legs, I'm bringing X numbers of amphibians to sell as pets. But if not, it's very hard because, for example, the exporting country, if they're not required to write a paper saying that they are allowed to send it overseas that it's legal, they were legally acquired or whatever, they do not have a record saying they went out. It's just like now, if they're not in CITES, everything is up to the importing country. Say, for example, we received this amount of frogs. This happens a lot, for example, in Europe. In Europe, it's worse than in the United States, because the United States, at least there's a database. But in Europe, there's no database. There's nothing that requires saying, okay, you have to register as, there's, for example, a species that just, like 10 species that entered the Europe. The only, for example, ultimate requirement is to, for example, register, a shipment of amphibians, just like that, so general, amphibians entered, let's say, Spain, for example, like 100 entered Spain. But the problem, there's no identification down to the level of what's the name of that species that entered.
Oh,
right.
Interesting.
And so that's, yeah.
So you don't have an idea. You might know that it's an amphibian, but not that it's a particular one, a particular species.
Exactly. Exactly.
How much are amphibians worth? Is it a big business? Is it?
Well, it's amazing how much the market is worth. If a collector in Madagascar finds an eel frog and says, okay, I'm going to go and sell it. So they sell it to an intermediary. So they receive, let's say, 10 cents per animal. The intermediary will receive that amount times 4. And after that, the intermediary goes and sells it to the exporter. And then the exporter receives 26 times that amount. So what makes it, it's amazing that, for example, the collector just received a tiny, 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 tiny amount of what that amphibian is going to be sold outside in the market. And, for example, I'm telling you, for example, it's an example of 10 cents per little animal for an amphibian in Madagascar. But, for example, if this is a frog that is included in CITES, in the Convention for International Trade, like the mantelas, the little ones that I was telling you that are very cute. It's $5 a frog. And so the amount goes up considerably. For example, when species are more desirable, because there's some people that think that the more protected they are, the more desirable they are. Also a big difference on how much somebody pays for it at the end of the market and how much the collector receives.
Just to clarify, for a perfectly legal frog from, say, Madagascar, the collector would receive 10 cents and I would pay $2.60 here in the U.S. but for something that was illegal, and especially for those very protected and very rare species, I could pay 50 times that amount. Is that right?
The $5 that I'm talking about is if it's a CITES species from Madagascar.
Okay, so if it's a protected species,
exactly,
then it becomes even more valuable.
Exactly.
And what about the size of the market for amphibians more generally?
For example, in the frog leg trade, it is estimated that it's worth $40 million annually. The fish trade, in comparison, is $42 billion, and the beef trade is $26 billion. Yeah, so it's pretty significant to have it. I mean, frog legs, I mean, little tiny frog legs.
So what countries are the biggest importers?
The biggest importers are France, you have the United States, you have Belgium and Luxembourg. Luxembourg, so tiny, but biggest importers. Exactly. Luxembourg and Belgium, so the tiniest. And also the biggest exporters are Indonesia. So I remember that I was telling you that Southeast Asia is a big, I mean, has a lot of amphibians. Indonesia, China, so exporter, Belgium and Luxembourg. Why is Belgium and Luxembourg the biggest exporters? Is because they do re-export.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are, and then, so if you kind of like try to picture the world, you have Central America that distributes to Europe, to the United States, and to Asia. But it's mostly to U.S. and Europe for the pet trade, because that they have the nice little frogs. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Then you have South America that goes out and distributes mostly to China for the food, for food consumption. Then you have South Africa, and mostly, I mean, it will be mainly Madagascar that distributes to the U.S. and to Europe. Same thing for the pet trade. Nice frogs in Madagascar. Who likes them the most? U.S. and Europe. And you have Southeast Asia that distributes to China and to Europe. So to Europe, so both are for also meat consumption, so frog legs consumption, so China frog legs consumption. Europe also in frog legs consumption, and the U.S. also frog legs consumption.
When you were talking about those statistics earlier, you were talking that most of the animals were wild caught. Is there a captive trade, captive breeding going on, or not really?
There is, fortunately. If not, we'd be completely out of amphibians. yes, there is. And actually, it is used for several reasons, but one for to reproduce amphibians for the frog legs trade. And the other one for also for the pet trade and also for the scientific.
Tell me a little bit about the scientific programs involving frogs.
The scientific one is used now to save amphibians from the fungus, from the BD. Yes, okay. It's very interesting. There's some programs now in Panama and in Central America and Costa Rica that scientists are taking amphibians out of the wild and save them. And kind of like clean them from the fungus that is going on and completely decimating populations. So that is very interesting. That's a very interesting program that is going on. And the farming, the other one for amphibians, for example, in Asia, that, I mean, those I've seen pictures of those farms. And I mean, it's just amazing. They just have ponds, like it's so many industrial ponds, and they just grow amphibians there. And those are the most successful ones because the pet ones are very hard to reproduce. I mean, farming in certain frogs are very, very, very hard. So it does not, unfortunately, sometimes the farming does not alleviate the wild capture.
Why is farming so difficult for some of the frog species that are used as pets?
Because amphibians are used to very, very special conditions, Some of them are very strict about the food and their environment.
When you take them out of the wild, like when you take birds out of the wild, there's a lot of associated problem with destroying the habitat, and then in the transport, up to 90% can die during the shipment. How is it with amphibians to transport them and take them out of the wild?
Well, you're right. I mean, actually, it's amazing how many birds, for example. This is not, we're not talking about parrots, but just I mean, 90 parrots, let me tell you, in the illegal trade die. And in amphibians, the numbers are not so high. I don't have an exact percentage of how many die in trade. But it is really important to give them better conditions in transport. And it's very hard. I mean, when you take out a tropical amphibian out of the moist and out of that tropical forest, or at the contrary, if you take an amphibian out of the desert, I mean, the conditions that they have in transport are very harsh, and they just cram them in a box when they're legal. I mean, when they're legal, kind of like you can see them, and at least they have a box. But when they're illegal, I mean, the conditions of transport are just incredibly bad. I mean, people just jam them wherever they can, because they're illegal, so they try to hide them. So
sometimes you hear about, you know, people wearing reptiles on their person, you know, in their socks, or you know, or eggs in a vest pocket, specially made vest pocket as they travel. How are amphibians illegally, you know, when they're illegal, how are they shipped? What are some of the methods that folks use?
I think the most exotic stories I've heard of other kind of wildlife. I haven't heard yet of an exotic story of amphibians. Yes, I have heard just exactly, people have so much of a big imagination to illegally transport wildlife, but they do find amazing places to transport them illegally. I'm not sure, because, you know, it would be hard to put it under your pocket, because, you know, it's kind of like they jump. So it's not that easy to kind of like hide them. I mean, well, a lot of people, what they do, for example, for parrots, is that they drug them so they don't move. And so I think it will be the same thing. It's the same thing here for amphibians, so they don't go out and jump or make noises, you know, because toad and all of them, I mean, they make their noises. So same thing, I think, I mean, they just drug them and put them somewhere. But also the same thing, they need moist. So some of them just live in water. So it's hard to transport them illegally and not have a big percentage of them die on the way.
I'm wondering about some big population declines. You had said in a presentation you gave to the DC Bar Association that Mexico has 364 species of amphibians, and of that, only 183 are protected. And then you gave some interesting statistics about in 1988 that there was a ban on the trade, yet in that same year, 200,000 were collected, or was it the year prior to the ban?
And actually, out of the, just to go back up on your numbers, which are very interesting too, so it's 364 species that Mexico has, and 128 endemic in Mexico.
Which means found only in Mexico.
Exactly. So Mexico is a very, very rich country in terms of biodiversity and of amphibians.
So tell me more about this ban on the amphibian trade.
In 1988, there was a ban because 26% of the frog leg trade consumed, I mean, all over the world, came from Mexico.
Oh, really?
And yes, and this is one of the species that was used. It was an endemic species. that was only found in a lake in Mexico. It's called the Lake of Pátzcuaro. And
what species is that?
This is the Ambystoma dumerili. It's a big, ugly amphibian. Sorry, but I'm not a...
not a good pet.
No, that was not a good... I'm sorry, maybe some people love that, like very much that. There's some difference in cases. But yeah, that's not my favorite, but could be beautiful to others. And this is a big amphibian, so used for the food, for food, I mean, so as consumption.
And what does it look like?
It is kind of, it's a brownish grayish that has, let me say that has, it's kind of like long and big, and it's kind of like flat. And the head in the front is, could be a little, it's more round than the usual ones. So it's kind of, so it's flatter and lives in the lake. It's very prehistorical, so people could say it's beautiful, but it has a look of like really a prehistorical species.
Huh.
So yeah, it's not appealing to want it to be. It's not like you want to have it in your house. But anyway, so it was overfished in Mexico for the world demand, and unfortunately, it was not only overfished for the world demand, for world food demand, but also, as I was telling you, for the medicinal purposes. And
what was
so,
it?
And that unfortunately.
Why was it desired for medicine?
It was used for lungs, for respiratory problems, to cure respiratory problems.
Oh, interesting. And so that prompted a ban, that Mexico put a ban on the trade of all
exactly,
species?
Exactly.
Or just this particular species?
A ban on this species, because as I was telling you, well, as you were telling me, 183 of them are only protected. So 183 are in a list similar to like the endangered species list that we have here in the United States.
Yeah.
And that means is that they cannot be exported, or they have their own kind of like a protection. So but just to let you know how many of them were exported just in 1 year between 87 and 88, so after, before the ban, 197,000 Ambystoma were collected to trade in a single year. And that's why they had to put the ban.
And do they have figures on how many exist in the country? You know, what percent of the whole population that was?
No, I'm sorry, no, I don't have that. It's, you know, it's very, very hard. Even if there is an endemic amphibian, and this is for all amphibians, there is very, very little data available.
Why is that?
Why? Because amphibians are very hard to study. And just the population is very hard to determine, and there are very little, there's not that many people, experts, that do the studies. And I mean, it's just very hard that they're not, I mean, if you go and try to find population information on amphibians, you're never going to find, you know, there are 200,000. It's not the same thing as polar bear, which is also very hard to count because there's white and then there are the Arctic. But it's not like other species. It's very hard. If you talk to amphibian experts, they're never going to give you specific numbers on how many amphibians there are in a place.
And I'm wondering what Defenders of Wildlife is doing in this arena to help protect amphibians.
Well, thank you for that question. Yeah, exactly. That's what I do, and concentrating on amphibians right now. And we have two different kind of works that we're doing right now. We're working with the Convention of International Trade Society, the one that I mentioned to you. How do we do that? We are working, supporting the proposals that were presented in order to list three amphibians,
What are they?
One of them is to list the Agalignis genus. The Agalignis genus is the red-eyed tree frog and the other frogs that are in the genus, which are very nice, and that they live from Mexico to all the way down to Ecuador. So Mexico and Honduras presented a proposal in CITES, and this is going to be voted next March by the parties. Another proposal is presented by Iran. It's called Neurergus caeseria. This is a salamander endemic to Iran, and this has really been extirpated by Europeans in Iran, and it's really in the it's critically endangered in Iran. So Iran is making a proposal to include it in the appendices of CITES.
What is this salamander used for?
But it's beautiful. It's a beautiful salamander with black dots and orange lines.
Huh.
It's beautiful. But yeah, it's just as a pet, and people love them, and collectionists love them, and I guess kids love them too. And but it's critically endangered, and it's been extirpated by Iran. So we're also supporting countries to include amphibian proposals in CITES. And the other one is Chile, which already included in Appendix 3. Appendix 3 does not need the approval of the other countries to include their species in CITES. So Chile decided to include one of their species, also endemic, called Caudiverbera caudiverbera, another big ugly frog that was used for the food trade. And so that's also, we have to support it, even if they're ugly. We're working with them. And the other, what we're doing is that, so we're preparing fact sheets, we're helping them lobby the other countries in order to support them to include the species in the convention to give them more protection. We're preparing side events for awareness on the rate of extinction and the threat of international trade. We're also encouraging other countries to prepare more analyses on which species should be also taking into CITES. So that's what we're doing regarding CITES. Also, what we're doing regarding the some international standards. This is very interesting, but what Defenders is just presented a petition to the Department of Agriculture and to the Department of Interior requesting to adopt some standards.
What kind of standards?
Well, what happens now, as we're saying, there are not that many regulations. And one of the regulations that we're trying to make happen is that if you have some amphibians that have the fungus BD that I was telling you about, that is really decimating populations,
yeah,
it that to be required to declare that there's a mechanism to declare that frog has the fungus. So there's more provisions and more possibilities to stop those amphibians to enter, or to kind of have to have a better control of frogs that have the BD.
Okay.
Because now there's no really mechanism to know if you're importing, if you're bringing here one of the frogs for food or as a pet, that frog doesn't have the fungus that is really exterminating populations.
Oh, interesting. So how can they determine whether it has the fungus? Is it something obvious that you can inspect, or do you have to do some chemical testing?
Unfortunately, you have to do chemical testing, as you're saying. Well, it's kind of like a swipe test with a Q-tip, and actually, I mean, each test, if I'm right, each test costs like $20, which is very, very, very expensive, that you have to do each for each amphibian. And so it is not obvious. I mean, it's obvious when they have kind of like, because you just kind of like see them lying there and dying. But it is not obvious if they have BD. You really have to do testing. So what this standard will do is that you have to do a declaration declare that there is, to know if kind of like if they're free of BD,
okay.
of the fungus, if they do not carry the fungus.
And so the onerous, the responsibility goes to the importer that to say that it, that amphibian does not have the fungus.
Well, kind of like when you're transporting your frogs, you have to accompany that with some documents. And the documents, yeah, exactly. Some of the documents would say this is a fungus-free frog.
So if people are interested in helping amphibians around the world, what can they do to help?
Well, first of all, I would say thank you because really amphibians are in danger. They're really in extinction. And first thing you can do is go to www.defenders.org, support our work, and it's very basic. Just please, 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 please do not throw chemicals in your backyard, in your little stream, in the river. Not contaminate crops because there's even frogs that could actually, there's, it's amazing, there's frogs also that control all the mosquitoes. Are exactly as I was saying, there's, they control the crops and all the infestations are. And so if you see a frog in your backyard or in your crop, I mean, that's a good sign. Be happy and take care of it. Do not consume frog legs. That's a big demand. I mean, it's amazing, but yeah, do not consume frog legs. If they taste like chicken, just my suggestion is eat chicken. And they're so tiny, and I'm sure so expensive. I mean, you just can eat them as a, in a bite. But do not buy frogs as a pet. I mean, frogs belong to the wild, and that's where they're happy. If you want to go and visit some amphibians that you liked and you saw it, where you can come back and I know if you saw it in Europe and you were mm-hmm. or in Africa and you were just traveling, it's hard to go back, but just take a lot of pictures and make a big poster so you can remember it. It's really hard to take care of a pet. I mean, amphibians really need very special condition to stay alive as pets. They're very, very particular and very sensitive to their environment. And just to let you know, I mean, clients, they do establish the demand for pet stores. I mean, if they see that that particular pet is not being sold, that's it. They just go back to another pet, another frog, and you can help make that happen. I mean, if you stop consuming frogs that are in the pet stores. And the most important thing I would recommend is to respect the biodiversity of other countries that really own it. We really have to take care of the countries that are so rich in biodiversity. Those are my advices for people like you and I, and for the governments, political will. That's my first advice, and that's what we need, political will from everybody. Because even if we know that governments know how endanger other amphibians, if there's no political will, nothing is gonna change. Cooperation among agencies, among the Interpol, among the departments of agriculture, among the departments of the interior, or the fish, the wildlife agencies, and with us, I mean, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Interpol and all of them, they really need cooperation. We also need more agents, please. That's for the Congress. we need more enforcement and trained agents. That's hard. I mean, it's hard to identify amphibians, as we were saying. It's just hard to have so many agents, we know, but we really need them. I mean, they're just located in so many few ports of entry. They're just, the big ones and amphibians. People just come in all ports. It's amazing that to believe this, but let me tell you, live wildlife worth more than dead wildlife. So, I mean, it's so much more if you just leave wildlife where it is and just let it live. it's really worth, I mean, it's and in the end, it will make a difference.
Well, that's a great place to end. So I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Great. Well, no, thank you. It's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into the amphibian trade with Alejandra Goyenechea. Now, let me replay you creature call number 6, which comes from a mammal that roamed North America since prehistoric times and used to be vital to the survival of Native Americans. Here's creature call number 6. Enter the Creature Call Contest. You can email me your guesses of the 10 sounds anytime before 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, February 15, 2010. You can send your email to me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. That's L-A-U-R-E-L at laurelnemi. That's L-A-U-R-E-L, N as in Nancy, E, M as in Mary, E.com. For detailed hints on all 10 animal sounds in the Creature Call Contest, you can listen to the January 18th episode of The Wildlife via podcast. You can find this and other archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can also stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. Next week, I'll talk with Lisa Tkancic, president of the Wildcat Conservation Legal Aid Society. We'll talk about captive wildcats and the pet trade. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.